Mr. Stopson, I'm happy to hear you in Peggy Young versus UPS.
May it please the court. I'm Sharon Gustafson. I'm here as counsel for appellant Peggy Young, who is in the courtroom today. Adam Gustafson is at counsel table with me, and Ariella Migdal from the Women's Rights Project is here in the courtroom as well. A reasonable jury could find that UPS discriminated against Peggy Young on the basis of pregnancy when it required her to bring in restrictions rather than a fitness for duty certification, when it ignored the provision of its collective bargaining agreement providing for light duty work for pregnant employees with a doctor's note, when it failed to follow its investigative process for all employees who request accommodations, when it failed to provide alternate work to the pregnant Peggy Young, when it provides such work to other employees with non-pregnancy related medical impairments, and when it failed to provide the disability benefits to Young because her doctor did not say that she was fully disabled, even though that is not the requirement for other employees. There are five crucial material facts in dispute on the Pregnancy Discrimination Act claim that a jury could decide in Young's favor. And by far, the primary one, the threshold question, is this: did UPS treat Peggy Young the same as it treated employees not affected by pregnancy, but similar in ability and inability to work?
Well, this is a very strange case because you have a policy that operates, it's almost a disparate impact kind of argument, because the policy sort of operates, the policy is neutral, it looks neutral on its face, but when you parse it, it appears to affect pregnant women disproportionately. So if we're talking about the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, and I think that was where you were going?
Yes, Your Honor.
Then walk me through, please, the analysis in the McDonnell Douglas paradigm and explain to me where, at which points in that paradigm your assertion fits.
Your Honor, if I may, I would get to that, but it comes to second step in the argument. There's a first step that I believe we have to look at first.
Okay.
And that is, we have to look at what the intent is about the Pregnancy Discrimination Act in terms of who the comparators are. And the plain language of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act requires equal treatment to pregnant employees similar in ability or inability to work. This is the sole criterion for comparison. So in this case, it is different than the McDonnell Douglas analysis. It explicitly alters it.
That's what I thought you were getting to. You're saying that that's direct evidence that obviates the need to resort to the inferential construct in McDonnell Douglas. Because it's direct, you don't need McDonnell Douglas.
That is true. That could be one way to look at it.
I'm not trying to put words in your
mouth. I understand.
I'm trying to understand, because it's a very, and this case is so, it just brings that, the tension to the fore. And that's what I'm trying to, why I'm trying to make sure I understand your analysis.
I understand, Your Honor. I do believe that there is a direct evidence piece here, and that is one way to look at it. But on its face, the plain language of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act says, we will tell you who to compare these pregnant women to. It is employees similar in ability or inability to work. So
you understand what that answer means?
Do I understand?
If that's your position, then we don't get to McDonnell Douglas.
I don't think we have to get to McDonnell Douglas, but I believe that if we do get to McDonnell Douglas, my client still gets a trial.
Can we stay on just that first point for just a minute and then move on to McDonnell Douglas? Help me with what cases support the proposition that you're advancing.
All right. And the proposition that I'm advancing is that to the extent,
that
the comparator is everybody similar in ability or inability to work.
No, I thought the question was whether or not, before you get to McDonnell Douglas, I thought you were right on point. The point was, you said you don't need that. That's when you have trying to find a prima facie case with indirect and inferences. Here, you're saying by the very statute it is. The question is, certainly she's a woman. Yes, she was pregnant. It's undisputed that she had an inability. And therefore, you look to see whether or not other people who had similar inability were given light duty. And yes, there are. People in workers' comp are.
That's right. And so our first category would be those who are injured on the job. If they are similar in inability or inability to work, they are proper comparators. And to the extent that UPS has a duty under the Americans with Disabilities Act to provide light duty, it has a concurrent duty under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act to provide similar light duty.
The language in the statute reads because of, and don't civil rights statutes that read because of, aren't they discriminatory intent statutes?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Aren't they? The question basically here is whether we're going to interpret the Pregnancy Act as a disproportionate impact statute or whether we're going to interpret it as basically a discriminatory intent statute, which doesn't obviate the need. I mean, you can use direct evidence to prove discriminatory intent, or you can use circumstantial evidence.
Yes.
But the fundamental question is whether this statute is a discriminatory intent question to which you can use direct evidence of some sort, or whether it's a disparate impact statute. Now, the language because of normally suggests disparate treatment rather than disparate impact, or at least the Supreme Court has done it that way. But the question I had, this same rule has been litigated in a number of different circuits. And you have just last year, the Seventh Circuit says, and I'm just talking about disparate impact now, I'm not talking about disparate treatment, says the modified work policy is not direct evidence of discrimination. The policy complies with and we were talking here about an on-the-job policy. Policy complies with the PDA because it does, in fact, treat non-pregnant employees the same as pregnant employees. Both are denied an accommodation of light-duty work for non-work-related injuries. That is all the PDA requires. And then you go to the Eleventh Circuit, which holds in the Spivey versus Beverly Enterprise case, we therefore hold that an employer does not violate the PDA when it offers modified duty solely to employees who are injured on the job and not to employers who suffer from a non-occupational injury. And Reeves in the Sixth Circuit said, Swift's light duty policy is indisputably pregnancy blind. It simply does not grant or deny light work on the basis of pregnancy, childbirth, or related medical conditions. It makes this determination on a non-pregnancy related basis of whether there's been a work-related injury or condition. Now you have this same rule with all these different circuits saying it's permissible. And if you take the statute and turn it into a disparate impact statute, as opposed to a disparate treatment statute, it's going to reap absolute havoc in the workplace at any point that there's any kind of disproportionate impact whatsoever. And I don't think that the one sort of outlier case was repudiated by the Sixth Circuit, and I don't think the courts have been anxious to go there.
Your Honor, I believe, and what I would like to show is that what the Supreme Court has said about the intent of Congress shows that the PDA means what it says, and that the proper people to look at are everybody in the workplace that are similar in ability or inability to work. The Rehabilitation Act of 1973 protected some people with disabilities, and then the PDA was passed in 1978, and the Supreme Court did not make an exception and say, you don't have to give them the same rights if they're protected under this other statute. And in the California Federal Savings case, Vigera, the Supreme Court was very clear that in passing the PDA, Congress had adopted the dissenting opinion in Gilbert in General Electric v. Gilbert that said that courts must consider the desired end products of anti-discrimination legislation, which may demand consideration of the uniqueness of the disadvantaged individuals, and that Congress intended that the PDA would be a floor beneath which pregnancy benefits would not drop, not a ceiling.
The question I have is when Congress uses the language because of, it can express a disparate impact, and it might, but it would. But when it uses the language because of, normally that means discriminatory intent.
Yes, but Judge Wilkinson, I point out that the Pregnancy Discrimination Act has two parts, and Your Honor is looking at one of them. The first part of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act says that because of includes pregnancy and related conditions. But then it says and there's a second requirement. And then the Pregnancy Discrimination Act says women and women affected by pregnancy and related conditions shall be treated the same as other persons not so affected but similar in ability or inability to work.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I know you don't have a lot of time, but can we just leave the ADA and the rehabilitation out of it because I think that confuses it more. I need to understand what you're saying that does. Are you saying that is direct evidence of pregnant, that if you can find an employee similarly situated in their ability to work, is that direct evidence? How does that fit with analyzing liability under Title VII is really my question.
I would argue, Your Honor, that it is direct evidence, but that even if it's not, we still meet the requirements of the McDonnell-Douglas test, and we still can show everything that we have to show. But when an employer says, we will accommodate some temporarily disabled workers with alternate work, but we will not accommodate pregnant women similar in their ability or inability to work with the same alternate work, if that's the policy.
Excuse me a minute, Judge Duncan had a question.
Thank you. The reason that I'm having a problem with that is, as you formulate that, you run the risk of, and this has been the rebuttal in the cases that have rejected the argument you're proffering, that you single out pregnancy to treat it better.
Yes, Your Honor.
It is only pregnancy that gets, that is entitled to protection for factors
I understand.
That similarly affect others, not I had an operation, I had a, I'm depressed, that you have created the very odd situation that you advantage pregnancy
and that
vis-a-vis
is not
the other health issues.
That is not what we're trying to do here, Your Honor. We're trying to give pregnant people the same benefits that other people had. And, Your Honor, what I would tell you is that it is an empty set. These other people who are not treated as well is really an empty set of employees, and I have the information here that can kind of walk you through why that's so.
But you see, it need not be, and that's why courts have been reluctant to go as far as you suggest.
But in our case, Your Honor, even if the court said we are not going to treat them the same as people who are injured on the job, and even if it said we're not going to treat them as the same as people who qualify for ADA protection, in this case, we have a whole slew of people who are given temporary alternate work who have temporary medical conditions that are not ADA disabilities and that did not come from on the job. Vision problems, hearing problems, back problems, I mean, all sorts of problems, blood pressure problems, glaucoma problems, diabetes.
Yeah, which is precisely the point.
And so in this case, we've got an employer saying, we're going to give all these other people accommodations, but not the pregnant person's similar inability or inability to work.
Not all other people, not people who are suffering from depression or
the person.
There are other categories.
Carolyn Martin testified that the person suffering depression, if he went to a DOT doctor, would be able to get a note saying that he couldn't drive. And then he would be entitled to an accommodation. So there are just so many people. What we are positing is that after everybody that UPS protects, the people who are left are pregnant people. They protect people injured on the job, people with ADA-type disabilities, everybody who can't pass a DOT test. And they can, you can go to a DOT doctor and not pass the DOT test because you had a basketball injury. And Carolyn Martin, in her deposition, admitted this is so. Or you had some kind of emotional distress injury. Almost anything that you can imagine, you could not pass your DOT test for. The only thing that's left, the only thing that can't happen on the job and that you can't fail a DOT test for is pregnancy.
But that's not the way it's written. That doesn't facially invalidate a particular company rule. You would have to look and see whether it was adopted with some kind of discriminatory intent or it was applied in some kind of discriminatory way. You would have to find some sort of discriminatory intent, would you? Because it seems to me what you're arguing is a disproportionate impact.
I believe we have disparate intent, Your Honor, but in Johnson Controls, the U.S. Supreme Court said...
We have disparate intent, and that's what I've been interested in.
I believe we do have disparate intent, but we don't need to have a malevolent motive, as the Supreme Court pointed out in Johnson Controls. Every woman gets to decide for herself whether to assume the risk of working when pregnant. And in this case, the employer didn't let her decide whether to assume that risk. Nobody said she was not able to work. Nobody ever said that. And they had an obligation under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act.
What is it that you want? I mean, I thought...
A trial.
No. What I thought, it was a bit of a moving target. Sometimes it seemed to me you wanted light-duty accommodation within the office. At other times, it seemed to me you wanted an extended medical leave. And then at other times, it seems to me you wanted to return to your job with the assistance of a handcart. And I guess like Judge Chazanow, I was confused by what it is you were actually looking for.
What my client wanted, Your Honor, was to be able to return to work when she was ready to do so and decided that any risk she was willing to assume. And the court has been very clear that she is allowed to make that decision. And the Pregnancy Discrimination Act says you cannot send somebody home because they're pregnant. You better make sure that it's inability, which is the reason that you're sending them home.
How many doctor's notes you have?
How many doctor's notes do we have?
Yeah, no matter how many doctor's notes there are saying that there's a real risk of injury here.
Your Honor, there was no doctor's note saying there was a risk of injury, and the Pregnancy Discrimination Act regs say you cannot single out pregnant women for the way you look at this. You have to do the same thing you do for every other person. Every other person, they send a note to the doctor and say, here are the essential functions. Tell us if this person is able to do the job. If they had done that for Peggy Young, the first answer would have been, yes, she can do the job, and we wouldn't be here today. But they singled pregnancy out not to do that.
Could she waive... any risk associated with an injury to her?
Absolutely. I believe that she could. That's another way they could handle it if they want to. But they were obliged to handle her request for an accommodation the same way they handled anybody else's, which was to get specific information from the doctor. If you look in the joint appendix...
But that seems to me a more granular inquiry than holding this thing, this policy impermissible on its face due to some sort of disparate impact. I mean, I don't object to getting into this case on a more particularized basis. What troubles me is the broad idea that we would facially strike down the rule. There's some absence of some indication of discriminatory application, and if there's some comparators of some sort, or
there are many.
What troubles me is the facial invalidation of the rule and transforming the whole statute into a disparate impact statement. Where there may be different ways you can prove that this was not applied in a fair-minded way, and I'm okay with that.
I think the evidence does show that, and a jury should have been able to decide that. I guess I have a 1-2 argument. First would be the policy on its face, and the second would be even if you don't accept that.
It's the broader argument I resist. It's not necessarily the other argument, because if it's applied in some kind of way that is discriminatory, that's fine. If some people are off the job or permitted with off-the-job injuries or given light-duty work, and pregnant women are not given light-duty work, then that seems to me not a good thing, that that's a, you know, that's a discriminatory application.
And that is what the facts show.
Well, yeah, maybe so, and that's okay. I'm not necessarily resisting that, but an employer, for reasons of workers' comp or whatever, can take a broad rule like this and say, look, our primary concern is with people who are injured on the job, because that is job related, and when restrictions come up off the job, that is something that we don't need to accommodate in terms of the PDA. It's like if somebody's injured in Nebraska, that's a different thing from saying that somebody is or has some restriction as a result of an event outside the office. Our rule is designed to focus, at least as it's facially expressed, is designed to focus on those who are injured on the job. We want to try to mitigate the injuries for which we may conceivably or hypothetically be responsible. And so it's rationally related to an employer's interest here. The on-the-job, off-the-job, normally employer assumes a greater responsibility for mishaps on the job than for events off the job. And now, if this rule is being applied in a different way from the way it's facially expressed, you've got a McDonnell Douglas claim. And you know, I don't. That's a totally different question altogether. It's just.
It is indeed.
It's just knocking down the thing on its face.
I just believe, Your Honor, that this court has an opportunity in this case to do what the Congress was trying to do, protect. With a PDA.
It would be going up against a lot of different circuits.
It's true, Your Honor. That is true. And that's why I would submit, Your Honor, that even without that, the court can look at these facts and say.
You really want us to create a conflict with all these different circuits? When there may be some narrower ground of relief?
I would like an opinion that said both things, that you they can't do this, but even if they
Fair
could,
enough.
It's.
So what I'm saying is, you know, you.
Fourth Circuit has done it before.
That's what I'd like to see here. You asked what I would like.
Well, but you want. So you want ground number one to create a conflict with the 6th, 11th, 7th Circuit, and who knows who else. And you might be on a fast track to one First Street Northeast.
I just thought I'd answer truthfully, Your Honor. That is what I'm
okay, that's fair enough.
Thank you.
All right, well, let's hear the other side.
Thank you.
Mr. McGee.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Emmett McGee, appearing on behalf of the appellee. As Judge Chasnow noted and Judge Wilkinson noted, this has been a constantly moving target. The plaintiff's initial claim was that when she presented with a 20-pound lifting restriction, she was denied light duty. That's what she complained about. And in fact, she complained that other pregnant employees were granted light duty under those circumstances, and she wasn't. Her claims have changed. She's added many claims, but that is the claim asserted in her EEOC charge, which forms the basis for this action.
Well, I think that's what made this case so difficult for Judge Chasnow, is it was very difficult to pin down what exactly was wanted and what exactly the claims even were, but notwithstanding that, Judge Chasnow granted mountains of discovery. She was looking hard for a comparator, and with this one comparator, I forget, they all went by numbers, E441. There was something like 180 documents that Judge Chasnow allowed to be submitted on just one comparator alone in an attempt to find if there was any kind of discriminatory application of this rule. So you have a district judge that absolutely bent over backwards to find a potential, you know, some merit there.
You know, counsel, your argument?
Yeah. Ms. Gustafson mentioned Johnson Controls. I think it's important to understand what this case is about and what it's not about. What it is not about is an employee, a pregnant employee who was working without incident, who, when her employer found out she was pregnant, they said, you can't work any longer based on some...
But that was a fetal and reproductive hazard
exactly.
case.
Yeah. And this is not this that case. It's undisputed in this case that the normal policy and practice is at UPS is that pregnant employees can work as long as they want to work through their, you know, throughout their pregnancy up to the date of birth until they come forward and say that they can't do their job.
But what it doesn't do is that it doesn't allow them to have to go to work under restrictions, a light duty.
It does not grant them light duty when they cannot perform their own job. That is correct.
That's
Honor.
Right. But you do allow that for people who have workman comp related inability.
That is true.
That's correct. That's undisputed, correct? Let's look at the plain language of the statute now. Yeah. Not just what we want it to be, but what the statute says. Okay. Now, doesn't the statute say that it protects a pregnant employee who she has to be given the same type of benefits of people who have similar inability or ability?
What the statute says, Your Honor, as Judge Wilkinson noted, is that you cannot discriminate against a pregnant employee because of pregnancy. Those are the words that Congress uses when they're talking about intentional discrimination.
I know that. It says because of. Certainly, it's because of. The person wasn't pregnant, then it wouldn't obviously be here. So it is because of. Okay. So that's just a feel of an
area. No, Your Honor, I beg to differ. It, because of pregnancy means that it can be because of other things that are unrelated to pregnancy. In this case, for example, the distinction being not because of pregnancy, but because of whether you incurred the condition on or off the job.
Facially, there are a whole lot of people who are not pregnant that are treated in the exact same way. Anyone who has some kind of injury or event or whatever off the job is treated in the same way, including lots and lots and lots of non-pregnant people. Now, if it's applied in some kind of discriminatory way, that's a different kettle of fish.
Your Honor, that is true. Ms. Young and other pregnant employees are treated the same as other employees who are unable to work their job as a result of rolling off the job.
If that's the case, counsel, then you could have any category you want to say, veterans of foreign wars will be given light duty, right? You could cover any category you want as long as pregnant women were not.
Yes.
Excused,
so
right?
let's take that. Saying? Yeah. Let's say okay. We have a policy that says that we will grant light duty to
veterans.
Employees. Let's say employees. If seniority. If you've been here more than 5 years, we'll give you light duty. If you haven't been here more than five years, you don't get light duty. We have a pregnant employee who's on her first day of work. She's not qualified. She doesn't have five years of seniority. The plaintiff's suggesting is that seniority can't be a distinction. Plaintiff or appellant is suggesting that your job can't be a distinction. So, for example, you can't have a policy that says we will have paid disability and pregnancy leave for executive employees, but not for rank and file. Okay. Well, an executive employee is similar in a pregnant executive employee is similar in the ability to work as a pregnant non-executive rank and file employee. But are they suggesting that you can't make any distinction in benefits based on seniority, based on your position within the company, based on what your job is? Are they suggesting, and this is what they are suggesting, that pregnancy is elevated to a status and level of protection above race, for example. If this were a race discrimination case, if we have an African-American employee who has a lifting restriction as a result of an off-the-job injury. Does he have the fact is that there's a white employee with the same lifting restriction who incurred that injury on the job. Is that unlawful race discrimination? Of course it's not unlawful race discrimination, because the distinction was not based on the employee's race. It was based on the fact that the white employee incurred an off-the-job injury.
Anytime you take something and make it a disparate impact statute, the consequences are just enormously far-reaching. And there could be any number of policies that are perfectly neutral on their face, that were never adopted with any kind of discriminatory motive, but that may conceivably have some disparate impact. All of those are thrown into litigation. It's why the other circuits have been so resistant to this, because they know what lies down the road. And this precise policy has been litigated. It's not been some other policy. It's been this one.
Your Honor, you're right. The purpose, the
intent, which has no binding effect on this court.
The purpose.
Is that right?
You know that better than I do, Your Honor.
I asked you a question.
Yes.
I asked you whether I know it better than you.
The Supreme Court has not ruled on.
Don't get glib with me, counsel.
The Supreme Court.
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Don't be glib with me. If I ask you a question, I want you to answer it. Don't tell me I know it as better as you do.
That was not intended to be glib, Your Honor, as opposed to showing deference, frankly. But
you have not done so, and I expect you to do so.
I apologize. Your Honor, you are correct that the decision of every other circuit court that has addressed this issue is not binding. But I believe you are bound by the intent of Congress. And the intent of Congress was to overrule Gilmer. And what it was intended to do is to bring pregnancy to equal status with sex generally and with race, and not to put it at a greater and higher status. And
Gilbert.
In fact, Gilmer. Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Is that what you meant? I mean, you're
yes, yes.
Me a case I've never
yeah.
heard of. So I
apologize.
What case you were talking
and about? The arguments that they're making are for Congress, and they're arguments that Congress has rejected. And their argument about the ADA as a comparator is the perfect example. The ADA is markedly different from the Title VII. The ADA requires more than non-discrimination. It requires it does require preferential treatment. It requires reasonable accommodation, light-duty work for the disabled. It's clear that the Congress, as recently as 2008, when they amended the ADA, did not similarly grant reasonable accommodation to pregnant employees. It stuck with the old rule that a pregnant employee generally is not considered disabled, is not entitled to reasonable accommodation. If Congress had intended preferential treatment, this elevated status for pregnant employees, it would have used the language that it used in the ADA, which is not only don't discriminate, but you have to take the affirmative step of granting reasonable accommodation to the pregnant. And the Congress has rejected those arguments repeatedly.
I was at the EEOC when the PDA was passed, and one of the issues that this interpretation raised is that it does have the potential, at least, to carve out preferential treatment for pregnant employees, therefore giving rise to a pregnancy discrimination, an adverse pregnancy, sort of a reverse pregnancy discrimination claim. I mean, it is actually an issue that could result. I don't know if that's played into the consideration of the circuits that have held the way that they have, but it is not outside the realm of possibility.
You're right. And Judge Duncan, I don't believe even the EEOC has taken the position that pregnancy is entitled to a elevated status above race discrimination.
In your view, how do you analyze this? Is it under McDonnell Douglas?
It's analyzed under McDonnell Douglas, like a sex discrimination which it is. The PDA is a definitional, it's a definitional section for Title VII. All the cases say that it's analyzed like a typical sex discrimination case, which means you consider the requirement of intentional discrimination, basic concepts like comparing similarly situated employees, and basic concepts including the defense that you can articulate a legitimate non-discriminatory reason. In other words, a reason for the actions you've taken other than race in a race case, other than sex in a regular sex discrimination case, and other than pregnancy in a pregnancy.
But how do we know this wasn't discriminatorily applied?
Well, because
I want to get down to the particulars of it.
Your Honor, we know that it wasn't discriminatorily applied because the undisputed facts are that the person who made the decision in this case, Carol Martin, the district-wide occupational health manager, who's a mother and a registered nurse and a career occupational health person, never granted light duty. For a male employee who had a lifting restriction incurred off the job. And it's undisputed.
I'm sure there are no off the job injuries that are sneaking in here. What would concern me most is if there were employees injured off the job, okay, who were not pregnant, and somehow they were being given light duty accommodations that were not being given to pregnant women off the job, then that begins to bother me a whole lot. And that then it seems to me you are running afoul of McDonnell Douglas. And I mean, is there some way in which this is some sort of pretext to do something? And right. The thing is, Judge Chasnow, this case has had more discovery than practically any case I've seen in a long time. It's huge amounts. Yeah. Of discovery,
right.
But is there is there any evidence that non-pregnant employees injured off the job are being given accommodations that pregnant employees were not?
No evidence at all, Your Honor. It's undisputed. Of
well,
course,
what about
this is
Williams? What about Williams' statement? I think, was Williams a male or a female?
Myron Williams was a male who was not involved in this decision.
Why is he making a statement like you're a liability?
Well, that is the allegation. That is Ms. Young's allegation. But the undisputed facts are that in this case, he didn't make the decision. The decision was made by the occupational manager Carol Martin, that she made it on her own. She made all the decisions on her own, and she made all the decisions without consulting anyone else. In an intentional discrimination case, which I submit this is, the focus is on the decision maker and the decision maker's state of mind, and the undisputed facts are that Carol Martin never granted light duty work to any male employee who was injured
what
off the job.
About non-pregnant females, were they granted light duty work?
Non-pregnant,
not just males.
Yeah.
Was anybody
okay.
Was no. Were light duty accommodations provided to non-pregnant employees injured off the job?
No, Your Honor. No light duty accommodations to somebody who was injured or had a lifting restriction off the job. Now, to your point, did somebody fall through the cracks? Did a rogue supervisor let somebody have light duty? Two points on that. One, it's irrelevant because it wasn't authorized and Carol Martin didn't know about it. But two, that's not evidence of disparate treatment because the allegations and facts in this case is that sometimes ad hoc decisions were made on an unauthorized basis to grant light duty to pregnant employees. And that's what this case started out with. This was a race discrimination case. Ms. Young was complaining that African-American pregnant employees were given light-duty work.
It's moved all around.
It has, but the point is, to the extent that there were ad hoc, unauthorized decisions by unauthorized people that granted light-duty to somebody who was injured off the job, the facts also are that those same types of decisions were made for pregnant employees.
What about the comparators here? What about this? None of them are actually identified by name, I don't think, but what about there was a search for a comparator. Okay. For somebody who was similarly situated but dissimilarly treated.
You know,
what about E441, for example?
The one that's a female supervisor who was granted an accommodation under the ADA because she had an ADA disability. I will also note that supervisors are not comparators for the simple reason is the policy is that UPS pregnant supervisors are accommodated and are given light duty work. Okay, so they're treated the exact same. The fact are that supervisors are given light-duty work. Pregnant supervisors are given light-duty work. So there's a distinction between supervisors and union employees.
And why is that?
Because that is the policy, because supervisors have, for two reasons, an elevated status. They're given additional benefits in many different respects.
Their fetus is more valuable than the other?
No, I think the point is that there's more flexibility with respect to supervisors because they're totally within the control of UPS because they're not bound by the collective bargaining agreement like the bargaining unit employees are. It's a completely different situation. With bargaining unit employees, you are also limited by what the collective bargaining agreement allows. With respect to supervisors, that's something within the complete control and discretion of UPS, and UPS can grant those types of accommodations to pregnant supervisors, which it does.
And the collective bargaining agreement has never, sought a particular accommodation to recognize pregnancy. I mean, the policies that we're looking at are all the subject of collective bargaining agreements.
All the policies that we're talking about in this case, you know, with respect to Ms. Young, are under the collective bargaining agreement because that controls the terms and conditions of her employment.
So the policy here is both oriented toward workers' comp and toward compliance with the CBA?
And given the fact that there's a limited amount of light duty that can be granted, you can't have the entire workforce on light duty, so you have to draw the line and give priorities
I understand there are limited number of office jobs. That probably the bulk of the jobs go to the drivers because that's where the business is made. But as I understand, your view is that, and there's no evidence, I don't think, to contradict this, but Judge Duncan makes a point with respect to these are CBA-driven policies, and they are driven by the fact that workers' compensation is implicated on the job, and you want to mitigate damages. And I suppose they're driven by the fact that a company inherently wants to exercise a special solicitude for people who were injured in the course of its business. And that's not wrong.
It is all of those things, Your Honor.
Do you grant light duty for people who are ill, who are sick, who are convalescent?
No. Light duty is not, if you have an on-the-job injury.
No, not inside.
Okay, so that's the circumstance under what light duty is granted.
So
there's other circumstances,
answer my question, that there is no light duty for people who are merely ill.
Correct, Your Honor. Unless it was somehow an occupational. They're ill because of, you know, they inhaled fumes on the job, and it could be considered an on-the-job occupational illness covered by workers' comp.
But just pure and plainly ill, there's no light duty. Right.
Correct, Your Honor. I see that my time is up.
Roger, do you have further questions?
No, thank you.
All right, Mr. Gustafson, you have some rebuttal time.
Thank you. This policy was discriminatorily applied. People with cancer.
Let me just ask you about this on
yes.
the discriminatory application. What more discovery are you seeking? I thought, given the voluminousness of the record, that Judge Chasnow had gone out of her way to give everybody an ample opportunity to put in the record what they wanted to put in the record. Was that?
No, Your Honor. We were allowed no discovery on anybody who had any short-term took any short-term disability leaves. We were denied any discovery on anybody who had some medical illness that made them not pass their Department of Transportation test. And this is a very important point because so many of the illnesses in the workplace here cause people to lose DOT certification. And UPS concedes in their briefs that they give alternate work to people with these illnesses. It's a myriad of illnesses.
What about comparators? Were there non-pregnant employees injured off-site who were afforded an accommodation that was denied pregnant employees
yes,
or Ms. Young?
Yes, Your Honor. There was a man with cancer who was, because of his treatments, was weak, and he was taken off his driving job and given light duty in the building. These are all in the briefs, in the appendix. There was a woman with an ankle injury who was permitted not to drive for a while and just to do work inside.
Now,
there was
a person Martin, did Martin make those decisions?
Martin didn't make hardly any of these decisions, Your Honor. Their own documents show that managers and supervisors could make these decisions. Martin testified she had 9,000 employees. She couldn't begin to pretend like she knew what was going on all over the building.
The person with cancer before Judge Chavanaugh?
Yes, Your Honor, I did. And Judge Chavanaugh said, just accepted what the UPS had said, that all of these comparators were either disqualified from their DOT certification or they were accommodated under the ADA.
Well,
but it wasn't correct.
Excuse me a minute. If they were accommodated under the ADA, then they're not similarly situated, are they? Because the ADA has a reasonable accommodation requirement?
Your Honor, the ADA says that you have to do reasonable accommodation, and the PDA says you have to treat pregnant people the same way you treat those ADA people if they're similar in ability or inability to work. But I want to move away from that because I understand that you don't accept that argument, and I want to be able to show...
I'm trying to understand why they would be comparatives in view of the fact that, I mean, I don't know, the cancer patient, they may have a substantial limitation on a major life activity, and there may be some way, I'm not sure that the company should be penalized for trying to accommodate a cancer patient.
But UPS said that they...
Excuse me.
Please forgive me.
I know you're committed to your argument, and I really appreciate that. But if there was a cancer patient who was accommodated under the ADA, that's not similarity for purposes of McDonnell Douglas. That's not a comparator, unless we want to sort of adopt a rule that no good deed goes unpunished.
Well, lucky for us, UPS specifically said that the cancer patient was not accommodated under the ADA, so we don't have to worry about that. We had the testimony of 5 different people there saying they saw this man, they know he was accommodated, and UPS said we didn't accommodate them. And the court made...
Has a question.
Oh, please.
I do. Under the collective bargaining agreement, what would happen if Ms. Young was given light duty? Would it create... the suggestion is that light duty options are limited.
Good 2 points. Number one, may I address it now?
Yes.
Number one, under the collective bargaining agreement specifically says pregnant women shall be granted light duty with a doctor's note in keeping with state and federal law. That's number one. It expressly says that.
That's why I can't understand, too, how is anything inconsistent with it.
There's no way that UPS couldn't give light duty because of the collective bargaining agreement. It says she shall be granted light duty with a doctor's note in keeping with state and federal law. Number two, this idea that there's a limited number of jobs, Carol Martin testified that she has 9,000 employees under her, and guess how many per year come with a light duty note for pregnancy? 5. She said a handful. We're talking about, and that's not just this building with 633 employees. That's her entire district with 9,000 employees.
You know that I wasn't asking about just light duty for pregnant. I was talking about the availability of light duty generally.
Right. Well, what the collective bargaining agreement says is that the people who get alternate work are people who, under the ADA, disabled, people who can't pass their DOT test, which is most of the people at UPS who are ill and can't pass their DOT test.
And you weren't given discovery on that at all, as to the DOT. Right?
And people, and pregnant women. Pregnant women are specifically, in fact, that's the only place in the collective bargaining agreement where the words light duty are used, is for pregnant women. But the people testified, everybody testified there, I mean, we have a dozen people, that's what I mean by everybody, saying that they use the word light duty for all sorts of different kinds of alternative work.
Could you give me the CBA side? Don't worry about it, I'll find it. Thank you.
I could in a minute. I can't.
No.
I can't write the second.
I
do I have? Oh, I do have another minute. The point about E-441, this distinction between whether she was a supervisor or not doesn't matter. Carol Martin said that the reason Peggy Young couldn't work is that her doctor had recommended light duty. With E-41, E-441, she came in with a note from the doctor for light duty, and then the records show that Carol Martin said, because that woman says that she can do a regular job, we're going to let her do a regular job. That has nothing to do with supervisor or not supervisor. That has to do with the fact that when Carol Martin wanted to, she let somebody decide for themselves whether they can do their regular job, even though the doctor had put them on light duty. And in the pregnancy discrimination context, the Supreme Court has said you must let people do their regular jobs if they are able to do it. You can't just try to protect them. It could be a nice motive, like trying to protect them. You're not allowed to do that.
But that's different about whether you have to provide an accommodation. See, there's, we're talking about regular jobs and accommodations, and we scramble all this together, and that's what's struggling me, is because I don't know what you want. You're first saying must be allowed to do the regular job, and then you say no, must be allowed light duty, which is not a regular job but an accommodation, and it just floats back and forth all
that's fair. It's muddled, and I apologize for that, but our position has always been the same, Your Honor. What my client wanted was to work. She was willing to work her regular job, and she was able to. She was also willing to work a light-duty job, and she was able to. She didn't have a preference. She never had a preference. And it was incorrect to say that this case came in as a race case. Race wasn't even in the original EEOC charge. We learned about people accommodated for pregnancy who were African-American. We added it, and then we learned, no, basically, this is a company-wide problem, and we let go of the race piece. But she has always wanted the same thing, Your Honor, just the ability to work her regular job or a light-duty job when she was completely able to do so.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll adjourn court and come down and greet counsel.
This honorable court stands adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9:30. God save the United States and this honorable court.